tax update for June 9, 2008. This week, step or no step, the Holman case. The tax update podcast intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio podcast. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. This week, we're going to go back and consider the step transaction doctrine, which is a court-created doctrine that was designed to deal with transactions that attempted to accomplish a tax result through a series of steps, what could not be accomplished if a more direct path were followed to get to the same end results, and in which case such intermediate steps appear to serve no purpose except to obtain that favorable tax result that otherwise would not be available. When the doctrine is invoked, the series of steps is, for evaluation of the tax consequences, collapsed into a single transaction, thus the term step transaction, normally resulting in less favorable tax consequences to the taxpayer. It's a variant on the substance over form theory that we've argued and or we've talked about before. However, it's not always clear when a series of steps will or will not be given independent significance. That question is one of two significant ones was dealt with in the case of Holman versus Commissioner, 130 TC number 12. In the matter in the case we're going to consider this week, to the IRS, this case seemed to present the same series of steps that the tax court had collapsed into a single transaction in the Senda case, with the taxpayer simply inserting a short delay to attempt to avoid the Senda treatment. However, the tax court found that, in fact, in this particular case, under these particular facts, this delay had a significant enough effect on the participants in the transactions to eliminate the ability for the IRS to collapse this transaction under the step transaction doctrine, and instead, we evaluated the steps independently. As I noted, other issues were involved in this case that we're not going to deal with in this presentation, specifically the validity of restrictions under 2703 and whether those restrictions could be used in valuing the interest transferred. We will note that that particular part of this case did not end up with as taxpayer favorable a ruling as did the part involving whether or not the step transaction doctrine could be invoked. Now, the question we're going to deal with here is whether, in fact, this particular transaction, which involved a family limited partnership that held securities in a publicly traded company, specifically Dell Computer, was actually an indirect gift of the shares of Dell Computer rather than a gift of the partnership interest. Regulation 25.2511-1A recognizes that gifts can be either direct or indirect, and it notes as follows. The gift tax applies to a transfer by way of gift, whether the transfer is in trust or otherwise, whether the gift is direct or indirect, and whether the property is real or personal, tangible or intangible. For instance, a taxable transfer may be affected by creation of a trust, the forgiving of a debt, the assignment of a judgment, the assignment of benefits of an insurance policy, or the transfer of cash, certificates of deposits, or federal or state municipal bonds. Statutory provisions which exempt bonds, notes, and bills and certificates of the indebtedness of federal government or its agencies and interest thereon from taxation are not applicable to the gift tax, since the gift tax is an excise tax on the transfer and is not a tax on the subject of the gift. An example of an indirect gift that we discussed there is found in Regulation 25.2511-1H1. In this example, a transfer of property by a corporation to B is a gift to B from the stockholders of the corporation. If B himself is a stockholder, the transfer is a gift to him from the other stockholders, but only to the extent it exceeds B's own interest in such amount as a shareholder. A transfer of property by B to a corporation generally represents gifts by B to the other individual shareholders of the corporation to the extent of their proportionate interest in the corporation. However, there may be an exception to this rule, such as a transfer made by an individual to a charitable, public, political, or similar organization, which may constitute a gift to the organization as a single entity. depending on the facts and circumstances of the particular case. The discussion here is of an indirect gift, in this case, either to or from a corporation using a corporation's intermediate vehicle. The point emphasized here is merely insertion of a corporation does not change the fact that there was an indirect gift from one party to another. We just hit it by having an entity in between, but we look through that and look for the gift from one individual to another, or a series of individuals to another, or one individual to a series of individuals, depending upon how the case was structured. But notice, not just a corporation that receives property that can create an indirect gift. A partnership would be treated similarly, as a transfer of the partnership is an indirect gift to the partners. Now, the tax court outlined that position it took in the Shepard case in the case we're looking at today, noting, in Shepard versus Commissioner, 115 TC at 380-381, the taxpayer transferred real properties and shares of stocks to a newly formed family partnership in which he was a 50% owner and his two sons reached 25% owners. Rather than allocating contributions to the capital account of the contributing partner, the partnership agreed to provide that any contributions would be allocated pro rata to the capital accounts of each partner according to ownership. Because the contributions were reflected partially in the capital accounts of non-contributing partners, the value of the non-contributing partner's interests were enhanced by the contribution of the taxpayer. Accordingly, we held that the transfer to the partnership were indirect gifts by the taxpayer to his sons of undivided 25% interest in the real property and shares of stock. Note, the mere fact that somebody seemed to think this worked, and we ended up with the Shepard case, probably tells you more about the what misunderstandings we have about the way these things operate than anything else. Unfortunately, I have actually run into cases like this in practice where individuals have tried to make such a transfer and then just simply allocate it out. That is, not understanding the implications of that contribution and the fact that the person contributing it needs to get benefits of that or needs to have that allocated to their capital account. Or if it in fact is split among all members, then we really do have a gift, essentially, of that contributed property to the other partners, followed by the contribution of that property of the partners to the partnership. But essentially, we have a gift of that initial property coming in, and that creates the gift. And you don't get to use any discounts for the fact there is a partnership interest sitting in between. The key reason there, for those that may not understand it, is an interest in a partnership is a different asset and subject to additional valuation restrictions over the assets that go into it. Why? Because if I own 10% of a block of stock in a partnership, that's different than owning 10% of the total shares. Let's say there are 1,000 shares. If I own 100 shares of Dell stock, I can go sell those shares instantly on the open market. However, if I own a 10% interest in a partnership that owns 1,000 shares of Dell stock, I would have to get rid of the partnership interest. That's going to be tougher because as a buyer, I can't convert that to cash. I'm going to demand that I get a discount simply because I have a lack of control over the assets in the partnership. Also, partnership law imposes restrictions and the inability to admit a necessarily a new partner unless the other partners agree, so I may have fewer rights than you do. All of these give us a greater discount than otherwise would be available. But the hitch is we have to have a gift, therefore, of the partnership interest. In the Shepard case, the problem was what we had was a gift of the assets which ended up being treated as part of the partnership, an indirect gift because we were attempting to use the partnership to backdoor accomplish a gift. And the theory, of course, in Shepard was we could discount that gift. Reality was the court said, no, I'm looking to the underlying assets. In a family limited partnership transfer tax matters, the IRS wanted to attempt to argue the indirect gift theory, taking advantage of the step transaction theory. Now let's move on to the Senda case, where the IRS was able to get the tax court to accept that view in a transaction where the assets were technically transferred to the partnership, and then immediately thereafter the interests were gifted. That was treated by the court as effectively one transaction with the Shepard result. The tax court notes in Senda versus Commissioner, the commissioner contended the taxpayer's transfers of shares to two family-limited partnerships, coupled with her transfers of limited partnership interest to their children, were indirect gifts of the shares to those children. in both instances. The stock transfers and the transfers of the partnership interest occurred on the same day. We said that the taxpayer's transfer of shares was similar to the transfer of property in the Shepherd case. In both cases, the value of the children's partnership interests were enhanced by their parents' contributions to the partnership. We rejected the taxpayer's attempt to distinguish the Shepherd case on the ground they had first funded the partnership and then transferred the partnership interest to their children. We found, quote, at best, the transactions were integrated, as asserted by the respondent, and in fact simultaneous. We held that the taxpayer's transfers of the share of the stock to two partnerships were indirect gifts of the shares to their children. That is, the taxpayers tried to paper over the Shepherd result by initially making the contribution to the partnership, crediting their capital for the assets contributed, and then immediately turning right back around instantaneously and then giving interest to their kids equal to essentially the portion of those of the contributed assets that they wanted to treat as gifted to the children. The tax court said that, sorry, you can't move so fast. There is no actual economic significance to the intermediate step of first funding the partnership and then transferring the shares to the kids. It essentially accomplished the same thing as if the kids were just, as we just gave them the property and then they contributed that to the partnership. Since that was exactly the same result with no risk in between, the tax court held we could collapse the transaction. Again, we're looking at a step transaction doctrine, and a key issue here is that arguably the tax court held that the substance of the transaction was no different than if we had actually just done it directly or directly had the given the gift to the kids and then had the kids form the partnership. There was no real difference in any of these intermediate steps. They were totally without merit because that partnership didn't exist in the hands of the contributing partners for any period of time. Now let's consider the Holman case. Tom Holman was a Dell employee who ended up with a large block of Dell stock, not an unusual result for many people in technology firms as we went through the 90s. And that served as a pool of wealth that he wanted to transfer to his children. Also not an unusual situation during the 90s for people with technology stocks. When Mr. Holman moved from Texas to Minnesota, he sought counsel from an estate planning attorney. That wasn't a bad idea since the court notes at the time Mr. and Mrs. Holman's had no wills. They began discussing with E. Joseph LaFave, a business and estate planning attorney, about wealth management and estate planning. Over the next 2 years, they continued these discussions, and the idea of a family limited partnerships was discussed to accomplish the Holman's goals. On November 2, 1999, the Holman's formed the Holman Limited Partnership, holding all interests either personally or via their trust. The partnership received 70,100 shares of Dell stock at that time on November 2nd. On November 8th, 6 days later, a gift was made of certain limited partnership units. On the Form 709 filed regarding these gifts, the value of the partnership interest was computed and used as a gift value rather than merely taking the underlying value of the Dell shares and the proportionate interest of those shares gifted at that time. Remember, at that point in time, the only asset the partnership held were these Dell shares. Now, to the IRS, the key issue becomes, this looks like Senda to us. The question is, was that an indirect gift of the Dell shares, or rather, was it a gift of the partnership units that we could respect, which would impact where the undiscounted value of the proportionate number of Dell shares would count as a gift if the IRS view was taken, or where the limited partnership interest, which could be subject to some discounts, would be the actual asset transferred. Now, fair warning, the decision on a 2703 issue we're not going to talk about here today reduced rather severely the amount of discount that was taken over what the taxpayers had claimed originally, but nevertheless, limited partnership was recognized and discounts were allowed when we get to the result of this case. Now, the IRS, as you might not be surprised to find, thought that this transaction looked to it to be just another variant in line with Shepherd and Senda. Their argument was, as the court notes it, the gift tax is imposed on the donor isn't based on the value of the transferred property on the date of the gift. Here, the property that passed from the donors is Dell stock, not LP units. I should correct myself. What I'm quoting from here is the IRS's own arguments on brief. Therefore, Tom and Kim's transfers of the Dell stock, not the LP units as of November 8, 1999, are taxed under the terms of Section 2501A1. Alternatively, the formation, funding, and gifts of LP units dated as of November 8, 1999, are steps in an integrated donative transaction. Once the intermediate steps are collapsed, Tom and Kim's gifts are gifts of Dell stock in the form of limited partnership units. Now, this integrated donative transaction is the potential issue the IRS sees. That term is a fancy way of saying there's nothing there. There's no there there. And therefore, we should just treat it as a gift of the Dell shares. To the IRS, the only reason the six-day period existed was, in essence, to try to distinguish this transaction from Senda. And it's basically window dressing that had no real independent significance. As you might expect, the taxpayers had a different view of the situation. Their response was as follows. First, no donative transfers occurred on the formation of the partnership because each partner contributed Dell stock, to the partnership, and each received interest in the partnership precisely in proportion to the assets contributed by each. Further, because the partnership was clearly and properly established under Minnesota law on November 3, 1999, petitioner's gifts of partnership interest on November 8, 1999 to the trust to the Minnesota Uniform Trust Miners Act account cannot constitute indirect gifts of the Dell stocks owned by the partnership on that date. To the taxpayer, the partnership had been validly established and funded 6 days before the interests were gifted. The question before the tax court boiled down to whether or not it was proper to respect those steps as distinct transactions or whether they should be collapsed into a single transaction of an indirect gift of stock to the partners of the partnership. Now, the IRS argues in this case that essentially we've got the same facts as Senda. Like Senda, even though the partnership may have technically been formed and funded to the gift, in fact, the entire transaction, funding, formation, and gift, were really one transaction where the parents took their undivided interest in Dell stocks and transferred a portion of those shares to their children. That was the whole point of the transaction. The tax court, however, did not agree with that analysis. First, the court rejected the IRS's first argument by noting that clearly the funding and formation took place 6 days before any transfers. That was different from the Shepard fact pattern where the interest simply flowed to the donees, or even the Senda case where it appeared the same things happened as in Shepard, except the taxpayers may have attempted to paper it over with a structured set of transactions that took place one right after the other at the same time to arrive at the same result as Shepard. So now the court looked at whether the step transaction doctrine could be used to collapse these transactions separated by 6 days into one. The tax court notes that there are three alternative tests that may be invoked to justify the use of the step transaction doctrine. First, a binding commitment test. Second, the interdependence test. And third, the end results test. The tax court, after considering the IRS arguments, decided the IRS was arguing for the interdependence test. The court notes, the nub of respondents' argument is the petitioner's formation and funding of the partnership should be treated as occurring simultaneously with their 1999 gift of LP units, since the events were interdependent and the separation in time between the first two steps, formation and funding, and the third, the gift, served no purpose other than avoid making an indirect gift under Section 25-2511-1H of the gift tax regulations. But the tax court noted for later gifts, the IRS had conceded the transfer to the partnership had significant independence of the gift. While we have no doubt petitioner's purposes in forming the partnership, including making gifts of LP units directly to the children, we cannot say that the legal relations created by the partnership agreement would have been fruitless had petitioners not also made the 1999 gift. Indeed, respondent does not ask that we consider either the 2000 gift made approximately 2 months after formation of the partnership or the 2001 gift made approximately 15 months after formation of the partnership to be indirect gifts of Dell shares. We must determine whether the fact that less than 1 week passed between petitioner's formation and funding of the partnership in the 1999 gift requires a different result. Now, to deal with this issue, the tax court returned to the Senda case. As the IRS emphasized that the Eighth Circuit, in sustaining the tax court in Senda, had not ever indicated that a single day was the key factor. There was no time frame mentioned there. But the tax court noted a basic inconsistency in the IRS's position. Nevertheless, the Court of Appeals in Senda did not say that under the step transaction doctrine, no indirect gift to a partner can occur unless on the day the property is transferred to the partnership, the partner is or becomes a member of the partnership. As respondents failed to argue indirect gifts on accounts of the 2000-2001 gifts suggest, however, the passage of time may be indicative of a change in circumstance that gives independent significance to a partner's transfer of property to a partnership and the subsequent gift of an interest in that partnership to another. So since the date was up in the air of whether that was valid or whether or not that date was sufficient to give us independent significance, the tax court looked now to the specifics of what happened during that 6-day period in this case. It noted that the price of the underlying Dell shares during the period between the various gift dates moved as noted. Between November 2nd and November 8th, the value of the Dell shares fell by 1.316%. Between that formation date on November 2nd and January 4th of 2000, the price of Dell stock rose by 17.745%. And between that November 2nd date and that 15-month later gift on February 2nd of 2001, the Dell stock fell in value by 35.748%. Note, we have here what's a relatively volatile stock that moves and can move significantly in a short period of time. The court noted that that variation did create risk, and some risk and actual movement occurred during those 6 days. The court notes the value of an LP unit based on its proportional share of the average value of the Dell shares held by the partnership fell or rose between the date indicated by the percentages indicated. Respondent has proposed as a finding of fact, and we have found that at the time Tom decided to create the partnership, he had plans to make the 1999, 2000, 2001 gifts. Petitioners bore the risk that the value of an LP unit could change between the time they formed and funded the partnerships and the time they chose to transfer their LP units to Janelle. Now note, and I should say as an aside here, obviously the reason why these donations were made at the end of 99, the beginning of 2000, beginning of 2001, was we were getting additional annual exclusions every year to make use of. But now back to the court. Indeed, the absolute value of the rate of change in the LP unit was greater from November 2nd to November 8th than it was from November 2nd to February 2nd, 2001. Moreover, the partnership held only shares of Dell stock on both November 8th, the day of the 1999 gift, and January 4th, 2000, the day of the 2000 gift, and the partnership agreement was not changed in the interim. Respondent apparently concedes that a 2-month separation is sufficient to give independent significance to the funding of the partnership and a subsequent gift of LP units. We assume that concession to be on account of the respondent's recognition of the economic risk of a change in value of the partnership that petitioners bore by delaying the 2000 gift for 2 months. We did have to wait 2 months in order to get the next year's annual exclusion. We draw no bright lines, the court goes on to note. Given, however, that petitioners bore a real economic risk of change in value of the partnership for the 6 days that separated the transfer of Dell shares to the partnership account and the date of the 1999 gift, we shall treat the 1999 gift the same way respondent concedes the 2000-2001 gifts are to be treated, i.e., we shall not disregard the passage of time and treat the formation and funding of the partnership and the subsequent gifts as occurring simultaneously under the step transaction doctrine. Now, what's important to note here is that the tax court said specifically they did not draw any bright lines. And in case you didn't get that, the court emphasized the point in a footnote at the end of the above passage. That note reads, "The real economic risk of a change in value arises from the nature of Dell stock as a heavily traded, relatively volatile common stock. We might view the impact of a 6-day hiatus differently in the case of another type of investment, for instance, a preferred stock or a long-term government bond." Thus, the tax court serves to emphasize a point that sometimes is lost on tax professionals who go to their research service and read the quickie blurb about the result of a case and decide the tax court held that 6 days is enough to go from formation to gifting, that you're going to get the discounts regardless. This ruling, like every other, involves the application of the law to a specific set of facts. And those facts are not necessarily the same and virtually never will be in a case we'll bring before the IRS. Our situation, our clients are not going to have exactly this fact pattern. And we must consider what impact the different facts we have versus the ones in the case in front of us might have on the conclusions of applying the law. The court made it very clear that a different type of asset in here would almost certainly result in a different result. That is, it seems very safe to presume the mights in the passage I cited above should really be read as would for this purpose, that in fact it would view an investment very differently if in fact what we had here had been preferred stocks that didn't move much or long-term government bonds that again had very little volatility during a 6-day period. What are the lessons learned from this case? In many ways, this case is the poster child for the difference that specific facts involved can make to the court. And it would note not just on this issue, but also the other matter that involved 2703 that we didn't consider and which the taxpayer didn't fare as well on. In that case, the specific facts involved with the taxpayer's testimony about why provisions were in the agreement had a major impact on the court deciding that those provisions needed to be ignored. They didn't serve a business purpose. Shepard gave us what would be the expected result. If you want to use the independent existence of the partnership to enable the use of discounts for a gift of partnership interest rather than the underlying assets, it's somewhat important to actually gift the interest rather than have those interests just inherit extra value from contributions by another partner. That is, you don't worry about substance over form questions when you manage to foul up the form of the transaction. Senda is a cautionary tale about the need to recognize when you undertake a tax planning engagement that depends on distinct steps and the taxpayer wants to minimize the step-to-step risk because I know what the Dell shares are worth today and I want to get those out of here because I think they're going to go up. So I want to make sure I get my discounts right now and at the number I know today. If you try to isolate that risk too much, you quite often get rid of the independent significance of the steps and the step transaction doctrine comes crashing down on the taxpayer. Similarly, in this case, the fact that there was a true risk taken by the taxpayers by delaying the transfer was absolutely crucial to having the tax court accept the partnership's reality. And the court made very clear they were looking through the partnership to the nature of the underlying assets in making this decisions as to whether they would recognize reality of the partnership or they would collapse the entire transaction. Now, for those that want bright line tests, the result in this case will be singularly dissatisfying, shall we say. They're not going to be terribly happy with the results in the case. But we need to recognize in this area of planning that we often find the only bright lines that exist out there are how to foul it up. I can definitely give you bright lines that will pretty much guarantee you are not going to get discounts. However, it's not as easy to give you bright lines that will be clearly grant you the discounts. You'll be clearly on the discount side of the equation. We need to counsel gift clients who are gifting securities in a family and partnership that the question of how long a partnership must be in existence for the transfer to be respected is not an item that we're going to be able to easily or perhaps at all answer right away. All we know is the longer it's in there, the better. How long is long enough? That depends. Obviously, the more risk the client has apparently taken on in valuation and changes of valuation in the assets, the more likely it is under the theory espoused in the Holman case that the tax court will recognize the existence of the partnership and not collapse the entire transaction. This has been the Tax Update for June 9, 2008. As always, the Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters that are of interest to tax practitioners. Be sure to visit them on the web. Also, a quickie reminder, I am coming up here very shortly on my presentation on IRS practice standards at the Arizona Society. So if you want to come a week from Wednesday to that presentation, or I should say a week from Tuesday, to that presentation at the Society's office, you can go ahead and sign up now. This has been the Tax Update.